I'm going to vamp just a little bit as Dr. Lee, our next speaker, sets up his computer. And it's good because his title is really long, and so I have to take a long time to use all the honorifics to describe him. But Dr. James Lee is the Edwin and Jane Weisskopf Chair and the Chief of Endocrine Surgery at Columbia University. He's also the founder of Collected Med, a software program for educational elements of surgical and medical teaching. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about some of the surgical considerations when dealing with adrenal incidentaloma. If we can get the AV, here we go. And I also wanted to mention that we will leave some time at the end of this session for any questions that you might have from the audience, but also if you have any particular cases that you'd like to discuss.
Beautiful. Thank you, sir. All right. Sorry about the technical delays. So I have the unenviable task of following the always spectacular Dr. Grubbs, which is a daunting assignment. But my topic today was the follow-up for adrenal incidentalomas and talking about a little bit about the techniques for adrenalectomy. As Dr. Shen listed my disclosures before. So you guys know who these guys are, right? These are the Beatles. So perhaps more than any single group of individuals, the Beatles had the biggest impact on adrenal disease in the last century. So EMI was a recording and sound engineering company, and on June 6, 1962, EMI signed the Beatles. They went on to shatter record sales across multiple continents. They sold out every major concert venue in the world. And a few years later, an enterprising employee of EMI named Godfrey Hounsfield said, thought that he could look inside people's bodies using some of the EMI technology. And so flush with Beatles money, EMI said, yeah, sure, why not, you know, go for it. And so on October 1st, 1971, he performed the first CT scan in a patient with a cerebral cyst. And since that time, the widespread use of CT scan has led to a huge increase in the rate of diagnosis of adrenal incidentaloma. And with that, you see a concomitant 64% increase in the rate of adrenalectomy over the last two decades. So it's particularly critical that we understand the appropriate workup and management of patients with adrenal disease. Dr. Grubbs has given a superb overview of who we should operate on and how we should work these patients up initially. But it's probably more important to have a clear evidence-based routine for following these patients because in contrast to the traditional pathway of identifying adrenal disease, where signs and symptoms will lead to an evaluation and there's a high chance that patient needs an operation, in the incidentaloma pathway, where the mere presence of a tumor leads to an evaluation, the vast majority of these patients will not require a resection. So Dr. Grubbs mentioned that there have been a number of excellently conceived guidelines recently. The ones I tend to put a lot of credence into, or the more credence into, are the ACE-AAS guidelines, and then the NSAT European Society of Endocrinology guidelines. The ACE-AAS guidelines were published in 2009. The more recent European guidelines published in 2016 with some updated literature, especially out of Italy. But when you look at these guidelines, it's important to keep that old adage, the old saying in mind that there are lies, there are damn lies, and then there are statistics, right? As any good statistician will tell you, when not used properly, data can be very misleading. And so this point was driven home by these two guys. This is Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman. These guys were credited with creating the field of behavioral economics. And in their landmark paper, Belief in the Law of Small Numbers, they show that even expert statisticians have an irrational belief that small samples accurately reflect the larger population, right? So I'm gonna try and explain that a different way. So my medical school friends and I, we like to go to Vegas every few years or so. We usually spend the night playing blackjack. But whenever I see this, right? So whenever I see five reds in a row on the roulette wheel, I always bet on black on the next one, knowing in my bones that there's an overwhelming likelihood of the next number being black, right? But you know, just look at all these red numbers in a row. But of course, when you look at the real world probability that the next number is going to be black, it's 50%, right? It's actually less than 50%. It's 47% because there are two green numbers. So the mistake here is that I think that this small sample with far more reds than blacks is a statistical anomaly, and that the next spin is going to surely even out the universe, and the next spin has to be black. But in reality, you probably need thousands and thousands of spins to even get close to that 50-50 ratio with any reproducibility. And so, for example, when you look at this sample size, you can see that there are twice as many red numbers as black numbers. So if this was the only sample of roulette spins you had, you happened to see, you could be forgiven for thinking that this is the way that the world actually works. And so we run into this problem of inadequate sample size all the time with the adrenal literature, right? So sample sizes of 100 or even a couple of hundred, probably inadequate. You need thousands and thousands of observations to be able to draw, you know, really statistically significant population-based conclusions. You know, but this is the best data that we have to go on. So when you read the guidelines, as Dr. Groves mentioned, you have to take them with a grain of salt because the best studies are based on relatively small numbers from a population standpoint. And most are retrospective reviews and at best meta-analyses. And the guidelines do a very good job of highlighting this problem. So this is the ACAAS guidelines. And so these guidelines grade the strength of each recommendation, and they tell you how strong the data is well. So what you'll notice for all of the recommendations for follow-up, that they're grade C recommendations based primarily on expert opinion and descriptive studies, with level 3 data coming primarily from retrospective reviews or trials with flawed methodology. Similarly, with the NSAC guidelines, they grade the strength of the recommendation as either recommend, which means it's a strong recommendation, or suggest, which means it's a weak recommendation. And then they grade the evidence from very low to strong. And as with the ACAAS guidelines, the recommendations for follow-up are all suggestions that are based on very low quality evidence. So just as with all guidelines, and Dr. Grubbs mentioned this, it's critical to consider the patient's entire story to guide you in their follow-up care and not to take these guidelines as gospel as the only way or the way you should do it. Okay, so as Dr. Grubbs mentioned, both guidelines agree that you should not operate on patients with small, non-functional, benign-appearing nodules on scan. So how do we follow these patients in the long term? It turns out the same questions we ask ourselves in deciding who needs an operation, is it functional, and what's the risk for cancer, are the same questions you ask in determining how to follow these patients with small, non-functional, benign-appearing tumors. So let's tackle the risk of cancer first. As Dr. Grubbs discussed so eloquently, the key to determining cancer risk is the size and appearance on imaging, right? And so of incidentalomas that are followed, it's not really known for sure what the rate of a benign-appearing adenoma developing into an ACC is, but it's certainly rare, but it's not zero. And so if you look at the literature, anywhere from 5 to 30% of these will grow over time, depending on how long you follow them, which study you quote, et cetera. And as many as 30% have been seen to grow at 5 years. That's probably a high number. If they do grow, the increase is usually on the order of 1 to 2 centimeters over time, and not that rapid explosive growth that you expect to see with ACC, which typically grows more than 2 centimeters a year, or you know what we like to expect. So based on some of this information, ACAAS recommends repeating imaging at 3 to 6 months, and then annually for 1 to 2 years. The rationale is that the rare malignant lesion will probably grow in this interval, leading to earlier intervention. So in contrast, the European Society guidelines suggest against further imaging for any benign appearing lesion less than 4 centimeters in size, with the rationale that so few of these will develop ACC on follow-up that it's not cost effective, which you know Dr. Wang will probably touch on a little bit later on. So in addition, the average CT of the abdomen and pelvis delivers about 10 millisieverts of radiation, and that has the has a 1 in 5,000 chance of inducing a lethal cancer in these patients. So this is somewhat less than the risk of developing ACC within 3 years, but the risk isn't zero. So you have to factor that into the equation of long-term follow-up as well as cost. You know, of course, you can always do an MRI as follow-up. So when they say suggest, what they're saying is that it's a weak recommendation because some of the panel members interpreted the data just like the AAS group did. You know, after all, even if a lesion has benign imaging characteristics, a 6 centimeter tumor, which has an increased risk of cancer based on size alone, was at some point a 2 centimeter cancer. And so you may be catching this in its natural life cycle on its way to getting bigger and bigger. So, you know, doesn't it make sense to get at least one additional scan? And this is where the risk-benefit analysis comes into play. You know, how do you weigh the risk of missing one of the deadliest cancers known to man versus a repeat scan? And so, as with all things, the truth probably lies in the middle somewhere. So our practice is to get a repeat scan at 6 to 12 months, unless you have a higher suspicion of cancer, in which case we might do it earlier. Then we base further follow-up on these results and the clinical scenario. So for example, if you have a lesion that looks like this on the initial scan, you repeat it 6 months later and it looks like this on the follow-up scan, you probably don't need to do anything further, right? So there's no good data to determine what constitutes significant growth as a risk factor for malignancy. So the ACAAS guidelines did not make a specific recommendation, but said if it grows by 1 centimeter or more, you probably should remove it. In contrast, the European Society guideline, the NSAC guidelines, made the recommendation that if it grows by more than 20% with at least a 5 millimeter increase in maximum diameter, these that should be removed. So it's important to note that these recommendations aren't based on data. So this is the standard RECIST criteria that defines progression in most oncologic trials. And so it's important to note that RECIST criterion aren't validated for differentiation between benign and malignant adrenal lesions. So again, you have to take that with a grain of salt. And then if there's growth of the lesion below this threshold, those thresholds, you should repeat imaging at 6 to 12 months based on the clinical scenario. So moving on to assessing for hormonal hypersecretion, the risk of developing a functional tumor over time is subject to a little bit of a debate. Initially, it was thought to be much higher. Some European groups reported that the rate was high as 47% at 5 years. That was a pretty small sample. That was about 64 patients. Dr. Grubb showed you some data from a larger sample of over 1,000 patients that showed that only about 2% of these patients will develop a clinically relevant hormonal excess. And this happens much more commonly in patients who have tumors that are over 3 centimeters in size. Pretty much everyone agrees that the chance of developing pheo or overt Cushing's in follow-up is pretty rare. If the initial testing was negative. Up to 11% of patients may develop autonomous cortisol secretion over time. And this is important because just like overt Cushing's, autonomous cortisol secretion can be associated with end organ effects and increased mortality. Because of the risk of developing autonomous cortisol secretion, the rare possibility of pheo and overt Cushing's over time, the ACAAS guidelines recommended hormonal evaluation yearly for 5 years, the whole shebang. You didn't have to do aldosterone and renin if the patient wasn't hypertensive. So in contrast, given the rare development of hormonal hypersecretion after a normal initial hormonal evaluation, the NSAID guidelines suggested against doing any repeat hormonal evaluation if the initial evaluation was normal, unless there are new clinical signs of endocrine activity like hypertension or diabetes. So a little bit of a difference here between those two guidelines. So now, if the patient has evidence of autonomous cortisol secretion without signs of Cushing's, that's a different story entirely, right? So autonomous cortisol secretion, or what we used to call subclinical Cushing's, highlights our evolving understanding that cortisol excess is a spectrum of disease, from overt Cushing's to patients who have asymptomatic states of mild hypercortisolism. So looking at the patients with autonomous cortisol secretion without clinical evidence of Cushing's, the most commonly used test to determine this is the low-dose dexamethasone suppression test, as Dr. Groves described, primarily because it's widely available, it's reproducible, and it's the most commonly used screening test that's available in the literature, so a lot of groups base it on that. So autonomous cortisol secretion is further stratified into the possible ACS group with a borderline dex suppression test with an AM cortisol that was between 1.8 and 5 micrograms per deciliter, different units but the same cutoffs that Dr. Grubbs mentioned. And the clear autonomous cortisol secretion group had a dex suppression AM cortisol over 5. And so the reason this is important is that even autonomous cortisol secretion without overt signs of Cushing's can lead to significant comorbidities like hypertension, diabetes, which in turn leads to an increase in mortality. So for example, De Bono and his colleagues followed 206 patients with incidental lymphomas and found that when compared with the normal group, a dex suppression test less than 1.8, the mortality rate was significantly higher in the borderline group, the 1.8 to 5. With a hazard ratio of 12, and that of the those who have clear autonomous cortisol secretion with a hazard ratio of 22. Similarly, Dee DeMasi and his colleagues looked at 198 consecutive patients with incidental lymphoma. They classified patients as having stable non-secreting adenomas, stable subclinical Cushing's, or worsening cortisol autonomy. And when compared to those with non-secreting adenomas, the survival rates for all-cause mortality were lower in patients with either subclinical Cushing's or worsening disease. And survival for cardiovascular specific mortality was also lower in patients with subclinical Cushing's and those with worsened secreting patterns. So this in combination with the fact that there's a clear association with autonomous cortisol secretion and without overt signs of Cushing's with a statistically significant increase in the risk of vertebral fractures, although these fractures are largely asymptomatic. And because of this increased risk of morbidity and mortality, the European guidelines suggest an annual low-dose dex suppression test and reassessment of comorbidities if patients have evidence of autonomous cortisol secretion. There's no data to determine a stopping point, so they suggest following these patients hormonally for 2 to 4 years. And so as you can see, when you lump these two European recommendations together, it starts to approximate that ACE-AAS recommendation to repeat hormonal screening for about 5 years. So putting this all together, our practice is to repeat plasma metanephrines once at a year, just because of the sequelae of missing that rare few or so dire. And then we repeat a low-dose DEXA suppression test and reevaluate for comorbidities yearly for 4 years. So we don't necessarily repeat the DEXA suppression test every year, but we definitely reevaluate for comorbidities every 4 years. So Dr. Shen also asked me to talk briefly about the approaches to adrenalectomy. So, you know, one of the great controversies that's bubbling up is the management of adrenal incidentalomas and how we should take out suspected adrenocortical cancers. So the ACE-AAS guidelines are unequivocal. They recommend open adrenalectomy anytime you suspect a lesion is an adrenocortical cancer. Because some studies have shown an increased risk for early local recurrence, peritoneal mets, port site seeding, et cetera. But this is mostly based on, you know, small level three evidence from retrospective series. In contrast, a number of recent European studies have found that that laparoscopic adrenalectomy does not have a significant difference in both local and distant recurrence rates and disease-free or overall survival. And this may reflect the fact that as we get more facile with laparoscopy, we may be able to take out bigger, more complex lesions safely. So for the European guidelines, they recommend laparoscopic adrenalectomy for lesions that are suspicious for cancer if they're less than 6 centimeters without any evidence of local invasion. Otherwise, this, you know, they should be done as an open operation. So in our practice, we typically use 6 to 8 centimeters as our cutoff for an open adrenalectomy. And, you know, there's some nuance in there. So, you know, if some lesions that are more suspicious for ACC, we may just do as an open operation and vice versa. So one of the other reasons that the rate of adrenalectomy has increased so much in the last 20 years is the advent of laparoscopic adrenalectomy, as you all know. You know, back in the old days when you had to make a big shark bite like this to get out an adrenal tumor, the calculus for sending someone to surgery was a lot different, right? So, for example, a lot of patients with clear hyperaldosteronism were treated medically when surgery could cure them because they didn't, endocrinologists didn't want their patients undergoing these big whacks. However, when you can do the operation laparoscopically, send the patient home either the same day or the next day, the risk-benefit ratio starts to skew heavily towards an operation for many of these patients. And this has been borne out by lots and lots of data showing that patients who have laparoscopic adrenalectomy have less pain, fewer complications, shorter length of stay, and faster recoveries. And large national databases like this sampling of the HCUP show that laparoscopic adrenalectomy is protective for both morbidity and mortality with an odds ratio of about 0.62. And so in regards to the different minimally invasive approaches, you know, my partner, Jen Kuo, will take issue with this statement, but robotic adrenalectomy is done in a very similar way that laparoscopic adrenalectomy is done, so I'm going to lump them together for the moment. So the standard approach to laparoscopic adrenalectomy is the transabdominal approach, which has a number of charms, right? So it's a more familiar view of the anatomy. You can do a limited diagnostic laparoscopy looking for mets or other disease. There is a larger working space, so it may be easier to do larger tumors through the belly. And it's flexible, and many people say that it's actually easier to teach because people have a much more familiar view of the anatomy. You know, the adrenal gland, it's way in the back, right? So when you go through the belly, you got to move a lot of stuff around, right? You have to move the intestines, some organs, et cetera, just to get to the adrenal gland. So going through the back, or what we call the retroperitoneal space, so the retroperitoneoscopic approach, is a much more direct approach to this operation. As Matt Nays will tell you, there are lots of advantages to the retroperitoneal approach. You can avoid the abdomen in someone who's had prior abdominal surgery. So I just operated on a master chief with the Navy Medical Center who had 5 resections for widely diffuse squamous cell cancer. We did it through the back in about 30 minutes because it was a unviolated territory. There's a more direct approach to the adrenal gland, so that leads to fewer complications, faster operating times, less blood loss, and you don't have to reposition patients for bilateral adrenalectomies. And so for this approach, we typically put people in the prone position with bolsters under the chest and the pelvis. And one of the knocks of this technique is that people say the anatomy isn't as clear as the transabdominal approach. But you can see from these images that the anatomy is quite clear and straightforward once you kind of get used to this view of the world. And the results, you know, speak for themselves. This is a study from Martin Waltz in Germany, who's really the modern champion of this approach. And you can see that this approach is very safe, with a very low complication rate, short operating times. And as you can see, later in the series, Martin's operative time, skin to skin, decreased to about 40 minutes. And you know, I've seen him do it in as little as 20 minutes. And in fact, when I was learning this technique, I went to visit Martin, who you can see here, and he did 13 adrenalectomies in 11 patients between the hours of 7:30 and 4. We had 3 coffee breaks. We had a very nice sit-down lunch. You can do this very efficiently. Our series at Columbia replicated his results, and we found a similar decrease in length of stay, EBL, operative times, et cetera, compared to our transabdominal cohort. Also, from a teaching standpoint, it can be taught in a relatively short period of time. In our series, when an expert like Jen Kuo does this operation, the average operative time is about 42 minutes. And when our fellow or chief resident does it, by the time they're finished with their training, the average operative time is about 67 minutes. So you can teach this technique pretty effectively in a short period of time. There are a few relative contraindications to the retroperitoneal approach. Large tumor size, you know, there is less working space in the retroperitoneal area. Having said that, you know, we've done 12 centimeter pheos this way, so you can do larger tumors through the back. The biggest limitation is probably not BMI per se. You know, we've done really tall patients with BMIs of 45. But it's more the habitus. So the apple-shaped patients tend to cause more problems for this approach, and so that might be a good reason to do a transabdominal approach. But since adrenal surgery is still a relatively low-volume proposition for most surgeons, the best recommendation in terms of choosing the approach is to find the technique that works for you, get very good at it, master it first before you tackle other techniques. And with that, I will close. Thank you very much.